Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared shortly after it took off from Kuala Lumpur on its way to Beijing on March 8, 2014. There were 239 people on board, including the pilot, co-pilot, 10 flight attendants, and 227 passengers. Many have tried since the disappearance to find out what happened. Writer William Longavisha is one of them. He's got an extensive piece in the latest issue of The Atlantic and joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what is known about MH370. It is presumed to have crashed into the Indian Ocean. How do we know that?
We know that with great certainty because we know what the track of the airplane was with quite a lot of precision. And we also have found, we collectively have found wreckage on the shores of East Africa. We haven't found the main wreckage in deep waters in the Indian Ocean, but we certainly have seen debris coming from that airplane washing ashore.
We haven't found the main wreckage despite extensive searches.
More than 2.5 years, primarily by the Australians, a huge effort, and still so far, nothing.
So one of the things that you point out is that one of the first signs of trouble was when the plane moved out of the Malaysian airspace, it should have checked in. The pilots should have checked in then with the next country, which I believe was Vietnam, right?
Yeah, they were flying straight for Beijing, just pretty much north out of Kuala Lumpur. They came to the edge of official Malaysian airspace, and they were handed off to Ho Chi Minh City, mm-hmm. Vietnam, and they never came up on the new frequency. What happened immediately at that point was that the transponder, they basically the signal dropped off the radar screens, and the airplane, as a primary target, turned left by more than 90 degrees and turned away from Beijing and started its complex escape route.
Is there any explanation for that?
We pretty much know, not in detail. I mean, the exact motive is not known. It probably will never be known unless the Malaysians open up a little bit more than they have. But we know it was a psychological issue.
A psychological issue by the main pilot on that flight?
The captain.
Mm-hmm. And how do we know that?
There are various ways we know it. First of all, through a process of elimination. Once you are very familiar with the technicalities of what happened to that airplane, you realize, first of all, that it was a human act. It's impossible that any imaginable series of failures could have caused the airplane to do what it did, that this was an intentional act. And then you go through the process of elimination. Well, who would have the intent? And you eliminate and eliminate and eliminate. And you finally come, as one captain there in Malaysia said to me, 777 captain, a friend of the man, said that you finally get to the top of the pyramid, and unfortunately it was my friend, it's one person wide. There it is. There's another reason, which is that there were various official investigations that were run by the Malaysians, mm-hmm. and Malaysia being a very corrupt, very secretive country at that time and still today, the police investigation was wholly inadequate. We know that the military was censoring the report. They were hiding things, but the police was the worst part of it because they painted a picture of the captain that was completely not true. If Malaysia were a different kind of country and the police painted a sort of healthy picture of the captain, that would have some weight. In this case, it has sort of the opposite of weight. Why are they going out of their way to paint the picture of the captain in ways which we know are the opposite of the truth?
Why do you think that they would do that?
Avoiding political embarrassment. It's not sure that they were covering up something that they knew about. It's possible that they were covering up something that they didn't know about, and they were afraid of what they would find out or what others would find out. Who knows what the motivations of a system like the Malaysian system are, but they're complicated and dark.
By the way, the captain was not the only person in the cockpit. Do you have a sense that he killed the co-pilot?
No one. I have no sense of that at all. I think we all know that the co-pilot was eliminated and probably not by being killed in the cockpit. More likely, he just excused himself to use the bathroom and was locked out. That's the standard system mm-hmm. To become alone in a cockpit. So it's very likely that the co-pilot was not involved in this and that he was excluded somehow politely from the cockpit.
And just one more question about the actual act itself. It sounds from your reporting like what you believe and what many people believe is that the passengers on the plane would have simply died when the pilot took it up to an altitude that was not sustainable for life, basically, without the amount of oxygen you would need up there.
Well, it's a pressurized airplane. So even at the cruising altitude, they were at 35, 37,000, something like that. We believe they pulled up to 40,000 with the first left turn. And that associated with that climb was a depressurization of the airplane. He threw a switch. So he, you know, depressurized the airplane, slapped a pressure oxygen mask on himself, and there are four of them in the cockpit, and let the other one's masks descend automatically from the ceilings. But those are not pressure systems. They're designed for short use for during a rapid descent to a lower, much lower altitude, and that airplane never descended.
Now, you introduce us in this article to a man named Blaine Gibson, who has conducted a very thorough investigation or a very personal investigation into what happened to MH370. Who is he?
Amazing story. He's a lawyer by training from Seattle. His father was the Chief Justice of California for years, decades. And Blaine Gibson has been traveling the world all his life and living on a small inheritance. An adventurer, an explorer, and he decided he was going to start searching beaches for debris. He went to Australia, talked to some oceanographers who were doing drift analysis, and they recommended he go to certain places in Madagascar and Mozambique. He started with Mozambique and right away found the first piece.
And he would pay the locals basically to call him and tell him if they found anything else.
He set up networks. The networks are still very active. It's still going on now. So, yes, he would pay local fishermen and villagers in remote areas of East Africa, and he started harvesting these pieces, quite a few of them.
Does the wreckage offer any clues as to what happened to the plane?
Yes, it does. We know that there's no sign of fire. There's no sign of a missile strike. And the wreckage is very small. In other words, we know that the airplane hit hard. This was not an intentional water landing. This was a spiral dive that ended up with a horrific contact with the sea that shattered the airplane and turned it into confetti.
Now, there is some criticism of your conclusions. One of the MH370 investigating officers tells the New Straits Times, which is a Malaysian newspaper, that your article is baseless and not constructive. What do you say in response to that?
There's no response to that. The article is based on very, very careful work and a lifetime in aviation. You'd have to ask yourself, how credible is the critic, especially if somebody like that, an investigator, that we know the investigation was in one way or another a cover-up. That's not surprising. It's Malaysia.
It's Malaysia, but they were helped by other countries like Australia. Did the Australians get involved and say, look, we've got to be more transparent about what's going on here?
They tried that. There was a lot of tension between the Australians and the Malaysians. The Australians were really running the search in the in the South Indian Ocean, so they were basically at sea. They had to do a lot of analysis, and they did a great analysis of the electronic signals to know roughly where to look. They were not happy with the Malaysians, and Malaysians were not happy with the Australians, and there was not a lot of communication going on. Even within Malaysia, the police weren't talking to the technical investigators, the Army or the Air Force wasn't talking to the police, and there were big divisions within the Malaysian investigation. Then you had people like the American NTSB who came in, very, very competent people, and they were excluded from the very beginning. And they can't really say that because there are all sorts of standards about what they cannot say or can say when they're officially assisting a foreign investigation. So their hands are tied or their mouths are taped, but they did not get a warm reception, put it that way.
Do you think that the rest of the wreckage and even the black boxes will ever be found, and will it make a difference if they are?
I have no way of knowing that. I suppose if you spend enough money and look long enough, it can be found. Is it worth finding is the question. And I suspect, not knowing, of course, but I suspect that the answer is no. I mean, we already know what happened. And we know that we know what the airplane did. We know it was an intentional act. And what else are we going to learn? Especially in the cockpit voice recorder, of course, we're going to, which is a two-hour closed-loop recording. I mean, you're just, unless the guy is talking for the last 2 hours, the airplane flew for 7 hours after it turned away from Beijing, stayed in the air for 7 hours. So probably we're going to have nothing there.
You think he was alive that whole time?
I have no way of knowing that.
That is William Longavisha, whose story about MH370 is in the July edition of The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
And you can read William's article for yourself at hereandnow.org.